Well, the conversation does not have to go on very long when you're talking about, say, the differences between Roman Catholics and Protestants. There will be the big ones, the big theological ones, having to do with the doctrine of justification. And then you'll get into the ancillary issues. And eventually you're going to come around to the issue of contraception. A Roman Catholic, at least officially, knows exactly where he and his church stands on contraception. They take a hard line against contraception in all of its forms. Now, their position may be a little more nuanced than that when you examine it, but that's a good description. What about the Protestant in that conversation? Is there an historic position in Protestantism for or against contraception? Have Protestants thought about it? Have they always had what amounts to, nowadays, a laissez-faire attitude about contraception? We're going to talk about Protestants and contraception here in the first half hour of Issues, Etc. Alan Carlson of the Howard Center for Family, Religion, and Society is our guest. I'm Todd Wilkin, and thanks for tuning us in. We're coming to you live this Monday, the 21st of May. That's the first half hour's conversation. Starting at 3:30, audio open lines for your questions and your comments. Now, a question that you might want to entertain during that open lines segment is, are you for or against contraception? And more importantly, why for or against? Or are you live and let live? Neither for nor against, which I guess would kind of be for. Also, during audio open lines, a Fox News story on the debate and the ongoing attitudes among Americans on abortion, a bit of a history lesson on Roe. At 4 o'clock, Dr. Thomas von Hegel will be our guest. We're going to talk about the Emperor Constantine. He's being remembered in the church on this day. In the third hour of the program, we'll talk about the best-selling book and DVD, The Secret. David Lewis, Professor David Lewis of Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis, has written on the subject, and we'll talk with him and with you about that in the third hour of the program. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850. Or 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Alan Carlson is a regular guest. He's president of the Howard Center for Family, Religion, and Society, based in Rockford, Illinois, author of several books, including Conjural America. And he's also written an article in the latest Touchstone magazine titled Children of the Reformation, A Short and Surprising History of Protestantism and Contraception. Alan, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Pleased to be with you.
Is there an historic position in Protestantism for or against contraception?
Oh, I think very much so, and it was against for about 400 years. We go back to the proto-Protestant Martin Luther back in the early 16th century wrote quite strongly in condemning contraception. So did John Calvin, the founder of the Reformed branch of Protestantism, was equally condemning in his approach to birth control.
Were the reasons for their positions against contraception and what we call today birth control, were they similar to or different from the Roman Catholic positions?
They were different. The key to understanding where the Protestants came from lay in Luther's rejection of celibacy as an option. Really, he just thought that celibacy was not part of God's will. You know, put a different way, is he thought that God's command in Genesis 1:28, be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth. Also, in Genesis 2, where telling of the founding of the institution of marriage is not good that man should be alone. These were not just blessings that God gave. They were even stronger than commands. He called them a divine ordinance, which it is not man's prerogative to hinder or ignore. That marriage and procreation were God's will for humankind. Procreation was God's greatest miracle. Featuring the lovely music of nature, as he put it, and that the deliberate attempt to prevent conception was in fact a very vile and terrible sin. John Calvin, for his part, emphasized that God's command in Genesis 1:28 was the only command made by God before the fall that was still active after Adam and Eve bit the apple and fell into sin, which gave it all the greater strength. And so the early Protestants, really until the early 20th century, the Protestant movement as a whole, had a very distinctive approach to procreation, which saw contraception as a great sin.
It strikes me that Luther and Calvin's position were exegetical positions based on the interpretation of Scripture, rather than the Roman Catholic position, which seems to be a bit more philosophical. I mean, it does draw in Bible passages to its help, but it seems to be a bit more philosophical about the role of procreation, the role of sexual behavior and things like that.
No, I think that's true. And it is, let's say take the classic or most recent Catholic exposition on birth control in Humana Vitae from 1969. It's a very interesting and wonderful document, but you're right, it's much more philosophical and less based on biblical interpretation. It's a much, in some ways, it's a more complicated analysis. Luther's was pretty simple. God commanded us to be fruitful and multiply, and he wasn't kidding.
How did he view Luther? How did he view procreation as, in some sense, fulfilling? I lack for a better word. Even in our fallen state, the image of God.
Well, he. He had a beautiful passage in I believe it was in his commentary on Genesis, which was, he did this long, extended commentary in the book of Genesis, where Luther said that living together of husband and wife, that they occupy the same home, that they take care of the household, that together they produce and bring up children, is a kind of faint image and a remnant, as it were, of that blessed living together in Eden. That's just really a very beautiful passage, and it was part of the way in which Luther lifted up the home and lifted up the roles of mother and father, of husband and wife, into what he called the most important of estates, more important than being a pastor, more important than being a prince or a duke or any other thing. To live in marriage, to create a home, was the most important thing people could do. And again, Luther derived this from his interpretations of Genesis 1 and 2 in particular. So I think we have to understand that Luther was remarkably pro-marriage, remarkably pro-life, bitter condemnations of divorce and of contraception. Most writers, when they dealt with directly with the contraception issue, looked to the sin of Onan, and sometimes form of birth control now known as withdrawal, and just condemned it as a terrible and wicked sin, much worse, as he'd say, than adultery, and much worse than pretty bad things. So Luther was pretty adamant on this. This was for him a major aspect of his social theology.
In what context did Luther encounter birth control? What, being ignorant of the history, I mean, we can talk today about the pill and ask hypothetical questions like, if Luther were around today, how would he evaluate the pill or other forms of contraception? But in what forms did Luther and the other reformers encounter this practice?
Well, like I say, they most often wrote about the sin of Onan, but Luther also emphasized that, you know, very much that abortion and contraception were alive and well in his day. He saw it as particularly taking place among the well-born, among, as he said it, among the princes, among the rich people of his time. Which, in a sense, wouldn't be all that surprising. That's sort of where it crept into when it came back in the late 19th and early 20th century. It was also among the better off that we saw this development taking place again. So, in many ways, our time isn't much different from his time. And Luther was living in a time, too, which had its own sexual problems. One of Luther's complaints was that against celibacy was that far too many priests were taking vows of celibacy but weren't living it. Far too many monks were doing the same thing. But he wasn't alone. Even even critics of the church of that time who remained loyal to Roman Catholicism, such as Erasmus, were also very upset about the sexual laxness that was taking place, and the degree to which vows of purity and vows of celibacy were not being kept by the priests of the era.
You're listening to Issues Etc. We're coming to you live this Monday, the 21st of May. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about Protestantism and contraception with Alan Carlson. Alan is the president of Howard Center for Family, Religion, and Society, based in Rockford, Illinois. In about 15 minutes, we're going to open up the phone lines for audio open lines. A question I have for you: do you think that contraception is wrong? Have Christians taken a close look at this issue, or we allowed it, like so many others, to creep up on us unawares? And from a secular standpoint, has contraception been a net good or ill for our culture? Think about that and give us a call here in about 15 minutes on Issues Etc. One other aspect of Luther's opposition to contraception was rooted, and I think you mentioned this in passing before, in his reading of Scripture, particularly its teaching of vocation. Old-fashioned words you use, husbandry and housewifery. Talk about that.
There's a wonderful book that I recommend by Stephen Osment. He's a professor of Reformation history at Harvard University, and the book is called When Fathers Ruled, Family Life in Reformation Europe. And he makes it very, very clear that never before in Western history has parenting been so highly prized as it was among the reformers of the 16th century. They saw the home as a place, a center for religious and moral and practical education. They stressed to a heavy degree the role that fathers needed to play, that childbearing just wasn't women's work. When the children were young, from birth to age six, the mother would need to take the lead in rearing the children, but by age seven or eight, the father needed to take the lead, and the father's responsibility was stressed. Dozens of what they called house father books were produced at the time to help fathers learn to be better, help men be better fathers. It's good old self-help books for dads from the 16th century. And they put an uncommon stress on the home as a place of moral and religious education, of the responsibility of fathers to be in the home and to be active in their children's lives. There's even some wonderful passages in Luther's, several of his essays, touching on marriage, where he talks about fathers washing diapers and explaining that when a father would wash the diaper of his child, that all the angels in heaven were singing praises to the father. So this, again, there's this stress that the home, the vocation of marriage was the most important thing people could be doing, and the openness to new life that followed from that was again a very logical consequence of this importance that Luther placed on family.
So, what happened?
Well, you know, for four centuries, it worked reasonably well. I think where did the weakness set in? And it really wasn't on doctrine at first. Most Protestant churches until around 1930, all Protestant churches remained pretty tied to the same Christian consensus that contraception was a sin. But the problem, I think, as I argue in the paper, and this is just looking at it purely historically, not attempting to catch blame, is that Luther's expectations here put a huge burden on pastors. The challenge facing a celibate Catholic priest was lifelong celibacy. That's a tough thing to do. But the challenge facing the Protestant pastor was the creating of a model home. A good marriage, a model and fruitful home with a large number of children. And actually, the degree to which we have statistics from the early 16th century up until around 1880, 1890, that was a common characteristic of Protestant clergy. The expectation that they would marry, find a good woman who would become pastor's wife, and they would have a large family. And that pretty much is what happened. I mean, there are some good numbers on this for some denominations, including the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. But all that started to break down around 1880 and 1890. What caused it? Well, this is when liberalism began seeping in to Protestant teaching. Modern liberalism, usually dated around 1877, its breakthrough, at least among mainline churches, but it just slowly spread, and I think one consequence is that by around 1920, dramatic declines in the family sizes of the Protestant clergy. They were still, in a sense, the church was still teaching contraception was wrong, but it was pretty clear that, say, Anglican bishops as well as average clergy in churches, including the Lutheran churches, were having smaller families. And something was amiss, and I think that tension there between teaching and behavior of, I guess you'd say, the leaders, the spiritual leaders of the church, caused a problem.
You chronicle, just as a matter of personal interest here, that there is a point historians can put their finger on in my own Lutheran Church Missouri Synod where the active campaign against contraception just kind of went away.
It just kind of went away in the 1930s. And, in fact, there was one of the prominent teachers in the Missouri Synod, Albert Raywinkle, I'm sorry, and pretty much decided by the 1940s that Luther had been wrong, that Genesis 1:28 was not a command or a divine ordinance. It was merely a blessing, and it didn't carry the power that Luther had thought it did. But there again, I would say that, without getting into questioning any one person's intentions, I think in many ways it was an accommodation to what had already taken place among private behavior. And again, I think I want to underscore that the problem that Luther created, the expectation he created, was that large clerical families. And it's become much more difficult to do that in our time than it was several centuries ago.
So when did, when we talk about Lutherans, we sometimes are talking about roughly a halfway house, at least sociologically, between Roman Catholicism and American Protestantism.
Mm-hmm.
I regard Lutheranism as evangelically Catholic. That's a theological definition that I'm comfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
But what about American evangelicals? What about mainstream Protestantism in America? When did the shift take place for them on the issue of contraception?
Well, there it's much more muddled, partly because that world of evangelicalism, as you describe it, outside the confessional churches like Lutherans and so on, it's harder to get a handle on statistics. It's harder to know, and they've actually been sort of less specific about teaching. One group that we can follow pretty carefully are the Baptists, and for example, the Southern Baptist Convention, which today is known as the most conservative of the Baptist churches, at least the large ones, actually became very accepting of contraception and even of abortion by the 50s and 60s. A similar thing was happening there. Now, what's interesting about Southern Baptists is that starting in the 1980s, they started turning around on that. First of all, qualifying their support of abortion, then finally of condemning it and actually condemning the earlier meetings of their general conference, which had, in a sense, okayed it, said it was okay in some circumstances. And even to this, more recently, even questioning whether contraception should be allowed too, to seeing that there's no clear line between abortion and contraception.
They're starting to sound positively Lutheresque in some ways.
Well, they are, and they're creeping close to Catholic too. What I think is happening is that Protestants are waking up after about nearly a century and are kind of rediscovering their own roots and understanding that, well, perhaps for different theological reasons or somewhat different reasons, that the Christian view of contraception or the Catholic view is not too far different from the Protestant view, at least as practiced today.
Greg in Memphis emails us with this question to Dr. Carlson. He says, I'm a subscriber to Touchstone, read your most recent article on the topic in this fine publication. I'm a great admirer of Dr. Carlson and of his work, As you were aware, no Christian denomination approved of the use of contraception until the Anglican Communion formally approved its use at its 1930 Lambeth Conference. Two questions. What impact do you believe the Great Depression may have had that in that change in teaching? And what consequence do you believe have resulted from Protestant acceptance of contraception, specifically in regards to divorce, abortion, acceptance of homosexuality, and secularization of Protestantism?
Well, I think regarding the first question, I don't think the Great Depression per se had much effect. In fact, it was only just opening up. You know, the stock market crash was in late 1929, and so by 1930, its full effects really weren't clear. Again, Lambeth, in my view, represented the accommodation of the Anglican Church to the behavior of its own clergy, where family size had already sharply reduced over the prior four decades. The second question, though, is a very important one. I mean, it's extraordinary. I mentioned briefly in the piece, between 1930 and 1962, you can trace just an incredible collapse of the Christian, of the Protestant family ethic. I think it was 1961, the National Council of Churches convened a conference on the Christian family, as they called it. It was a deeply disturbing event, because not only was there no one there speaking in defense of the Luther's and Calvin's view, not a soul, that they had it was a veritable who's who of sexual radicals. They had the head of Planned Parenthood. They had the head of the, Alan Guttmacher, another. They were arguing, this is 1961, they were arguing for the full acceptance of homosexuality. They were arguing for, as one speaker said, a sexual economy of abundance where contraception would allow all kinds of things. There was praise for homosexuality. There was calls for eliminating controls on abortion. Again, this was 12 years before Roe v. Wade. And this was supposedly represented the best, most progressive thinking among the American Protestant mainline. It was a deeply disturbing event. And which underlines what I think is once the line was crossed on contraception, there was not another good line to fall back on and defend. I think that became the problem. I think to some degree that's what Pope Paul VI said in Humana Vitae, is that you can't do one thing without a whole lot of other things following in consequence. Now some would say, no, you can't. You know, you can make distinctions between contraception and abortion, and between abortion and homosexuality. But at least historically speaking, among American Protestants, once the line was crossed, 1931, when the Federal Council of Churches embraced at least some kinds of contraception, it was a very quick fall into just a collapse.
Profam.org is the website address for the Howard Center for Family, Religion, and Society. Alan Carlson is president of the Howard Center for Family, Religion, and Society. He's author of several books, including Conjugal America, and he's also written an article in the latest issue of Touchstone Magazine titled Children of the Reformation. When we come back, your phone calls are an email on contraception. Stay tuned.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Today, many Christians read the Bible as an owner's manual, as a series of instructions and moral lessons, as a book of principles for living. This way of reading Scripture robs the Christian of the true comfort of God's Word. It turns the Bible into a book about the Christian rather than a book about the Christ. Our Issues Etc. book of the month for May is called Word, God Speaks to Us. It's Christ-centered, cross-focused. It's written by Pastor John Pless. You can find it at one of the two Concordia Publishing House bookstores at 3558 South Jefferson in the city or on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton. The book is called Word, God Speaks to Us. It's $8.99 plus shipping and handling. That's 3558 South Jefferson in the city or on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton. It's the Issues Etc. book of the month for May.
Go, my children, with my blessing. Go, my children, with my blessing. It's one of the many songs on a new recording titled The Temba Girls with the Aaron Bodie Group. Jazz recording artist Aaron Bodie teamed with the girls' choir in South Africa to produce this new CD. And proceeds from this recording will benefit the Temba Trust, a nonprofit foundation that operates a girls' school and other educational and youth programs that serve South Africa's rural poor. For more information on the Temba Girls with the Aaron Bodie Group, check out our homepage, issuesetc.org. For a $25 donation to LCMS World Relief, you can get a CD with great music and also help South African children. Issuesetc.org, the Temba Girls with the Aaron Bodie Group.
This presentation of the Meyer Minute on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Thrivent Financial, where values thrive, and online at thrivent.com.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Columnist Eleanor Margraf wrote about a bout she had with pneumonia. Confined to her home, she turned to books. I can't think for a minute why I planned to read the letters from Harry Truman to his wife, Bess. Initially, Harry seemed like a fine guy, concerned and doting toward his wife and child, but after a couple hundred letters, I started feeling downright sorry for Bess. Ha! When I discovered Diane had kept all the letters I wrote her when we were dating, I felt sorry for her, and embarrassed by my cloddish style. We still laugh about it. That bundle of boring letters, most of them always saying the same thing. No one's ever described me as romantic, but still she kept the letters. Maybe she saw something in our relationship, something she's nourished for over 30 years. I thank heaven for her patience, waiting as she has for me to realize what a wonderful thing our long-worked-at marriage is. Well, Mrs. Margraf wrote about Bess Truman. Why she saved the things is beyond me. Well, I think, after all these years of marriage, that the answer is love. And I'm certainly slow to understand love. And I think most of us men are. Thanks for thinking about that. I'm Dale Meyer.
This presentation of the Meyer Minute on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Thrivent Financial, online at thrivent.com. We do more than work. We work with a purpose.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Half hour of open lines ahead for your questions and your comments and your answer to this question. Coming up, that conversation with Alan Carlson on the Protestant history regarding contraception. It's really, there's no debate among historians as to whether or not Luther was of the opinion that contraception, in whatever form he encountered it, was against the Word of God. What I want to know is, what about you? You don't even have to talk about Luther. You can talk about Calvin, too. The two major streams of Protestantism, roughly defined, historically have been against contraception. So I'm looking for your answers to these questions. Is contraception a sin? Our in-studio email address this Monday, the 21st of May, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Our call-in numbers, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Have we looked carefully enough at the issue of contraception today? 1-800-730-2727, 505-7850, or issuesetc@kfuo.org. Has contraception been good or bad overall for the culture? Now, I'm asking this question just purely as kind of a sociological, as you observe it, sociologically, has contraception been a net good or a net bad for our society? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, and you can email us here in the studio. It's audio open lines, issuesetc@kfuo.org, issuesetc@kfuo.org, a little bit later during open lines, as time permits. We'll get to a Fox News story and a debate on Americans' attitudes toward abortion. Remarkably, the attitudes, at least as the polls indicate, toward abortion have changed very little, if any, at all in 34 years since Roe v. Wade. It's amazing. But the number of abortions, they've gone up. They've gone down, and now they're on the rise again. We'll hear that in just a few minutes here during Audio Open Lines. 1-800-730-2727 or 505-7850. Let's talk with Bernard, who calls from his car. Hi, Bernard.
Howdy. How you doing there?
I'm doing well.
You were talking about contraception. I just had a general comment, if it were, on what effects it's having on society. We're not seeing it so far here in the States, but if you look over what's happening in Europe in the past 30 years or so, what you're seeing is that you have the two cultures. You have the Muslim and the African immigrants moving into Europe, but then you have the indigenous Europeans that are, for the most part, Catholic and Protestant. And the overall widespread acceptance of contraception, if you look at the population demographics, the Europeans are actually breeding themselves out. They're becoming so successful and so happy with their lives that they're forgetting to have kids, whereas the immigrants are completely against it. So as a result, in about 30 or 40 years, you could see them having the absolute majority over in Europe. So that's a problem that any group of people would have to worry about when you openly embrace something that inhibits the ability to continue your own population.
Bernard, thank you very much. We were talking, now I don't remember what the guest was, but we were talking recently on the program about, it's usually called the Islamization of Europe, and there are varying opinions, varying projections, but the guest that we were talking with thought that the projection of 2050, which the one we were dealing with, for a majority in some countries like Germany and France and perhaps even Great Britain, a majority Muslim population by 2050, the guest thought that might be, even be a little too far out. Maybe even 15 years earlier, 2035. And it really does have to do with the simple math. If Western Europeans, on the whole, are experiencing not only zero population growth, but negative population growth. In other words, the average married couple are not replacing themselves. You got to have the old statistic you've heard that everyone chuckles at, 2.5 kids to replace two parents. Well, they're at 1.8, 1.7. The United States is hovering around 2. We're right at replacement levels. And if immigrant Muslims and others say fooey on contraception and outbreed the indigenous populations, the non-immigrant populations in Western Europe, it's going to happen sooner or later. Bernard, thank you very much. That's one. That's the force of math. What other effects, good or ill, do you think contraception has had in our society? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, it's audioopenlines, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Do you think that contraception is a sin? Do you think that we have examined the issue closely enough? Or is it kind of like in vitro fertilization? A separate issue, of course, but in some sense, in vitro fertilization and all of the questions that it's now raising ethically crept in under the radar, especially with regard to Protestants. Roman Catholics saw it for what it was, and they were deeply concerned about it. But by and large, Protestants weren't paying that close attention to the ethical problems that might be presented by in vitro fertilization. Not by just the technique, but by the way it's carried out. Is the same true of contraception with regard to Protestants here in America? 1-800-730-2727, 505-7850. Selena is calling from her car. Hi, Selena.
I think that possibly the use of contraception has increased the promiscuity in this country and all over the world because there's no longer the same consequence for sex. And so if people feel like they can have sex without consequences, it doesn't make any difference.
So general promiscuity?
Right.
Thank you very much, Selena. Okay, I don't know if anyone could argue with this. You can blame it on the sexual revolution as a philosophical moral movement. But few sociologists looking back on the sexual revolution would discount or underestimate the simple fact that the pill had as much to do with the sexual revolution as anything else. Thank you for the call. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Jean is calling from Arizona. Am I getting your name right, Jean?
It's actually Jeannie.
Jeannie,
that's okay. I answered to both.
What's your question or comment, Jeannie?
Well, I want to say I agree with the previous caller. I do believe that is one byproduct of contraception. I also think that it makes people more selfish. And another thing, too, I've dealt with this in my life, too, because I was raised in a church that was strictly against contraception. So I always raised to believe that's the case. And then I left that church because it was legalistic. But I still, I've questioned the whole idea of contraception, about whether it's right or wrong. But I did find a psalm that I found very interesting. And it was Psalm 127, if you know what that is. It's, blessed is the man. It says here, sons are a heritage from the Lord, children a reward from him. Like arrows in the hands of a warrior are sons born in one's youth. And it says, blessed is the man whose quiver is full of them, they will not be put to shame. And I just thought that was interesting.
Jeannie, thank you very much, and thanks for listening out there in Arizona. Our in-studio email address, we're talking about contraception. Is it a sin? Is it wrong? Have Protestants been asleep at the switch on this issue? Many are reexamining the issue. Do you think that contraception has been a net good or ill for our society? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or issues etc. at kfuo.org. So far, three callers who are concerned about the ill effects of contraception. What about the rest of you? Jean calls from Edwardsville. Thanks for waiting, Jean.
Hi there. Hey, I'm on a cell phone, so I'm going to do this as fast as I can. Using that same verse that you just did, I wonder many times in my life if God, I gave birth to three boys, and I wonder what if he had in mind for me to have more children than that, and who am I to tell God that I don't want his blessings? Isn't that what sexual intercourse is meant for, between two people who love each other? When we start limiting the number of our family, are we not playing God?
Jean, thank you very much. Now, there's a simple kind of grassroots, no-nonsense question. Children are a blessing from God. Everybody says this, a gift from God. When a baby is born, we say it's a gift from heaven. Was it Jeannie who from Arizona who said it makes us more selfish? Contraception has made us more selfish. The bar of selfishness, like anything else, tends to get moved higher and higher and higher. And a lot of it has to do with the circumstances of our life. When you come to expect something in your life, or as an ordinary course of events, you come to expect it, you come to require it. It becomes for you an inalienable right. You know, the old joke with husbands is that you should not be careful about how competent you appear to be in front of your wife when she gives you the honey-do list. Because if you do everything well, she'll expect you to do everything well, and the list will only grow. It's a little rule of thumb most husbands live by, either quietly or they admit to it, like me. If you appear to be competent in everything you do, the expectations are going to rise. So maybe mess something up occasionally, and your wife will shake her head and do it herself and won't expect you to do that again. When the honey-do list is made the next week, she won't put that on the list. I jest, in part, but think about it. Our expectations tend to rise with what we think is a bare minimum. And if we think a bare minimum is we get to choose when we have our kids, that's just bottom line. There's your bar for self-satisfaction. There's your bar. Anything less than that, in some cases, would be considered dissatisfaction. Catherine's calling from her car. Catherine.
Hi.
Welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you. I'm getting feedback. I'm sorry.
That's all right. Do you have your radio on by any chance?
It's on, but I can turn it off.
Why don't you turn it off, and I think it'll help a little bit.
There we go.
All right.
Okay. What I wonder, and I think that all these ladies that have called in, and men too, they have a point. However, what is that magic number that's all of a sudden letting God be God, you know, is 4 enough or is 7 enough? Or do you need to keep having children till you have 13 or 14? You know, how do you say, well, I've definitely stopped being selfish now?
I filled my quota.
Yes. And I think it's like you said, it's a blessing, not necessarily a legalistic command.
Catherine, I think I know what you're saying. Thank you very much. Now, let me see if I can play this out. Children are a gift from God, and they are a blessing. Now, if a gift is, what, like they used to say in the old mafioso movies, an offer you cannot refuse, I'm going to make you an offer you can't refuse, it stops being a gift and starts being an obligation. Now, maybe the problem is with our attitude. We turn up our nose at the gifts and we look at them as obligations rather than blessings and gifts. That is altogether true. We're fully capable of that. But if we're going to mount an argument against contraception that is going to be based on, here's an offer you can't refuse, that would be an approach that is more coercive than anything else. Don't you agree? And Catherine does raise a good question. It's a good question that anyone who says, well, you got to have more kids, you can't stop having kids, if you're going to make that argument, then you do have to answer the question, so when is enough enough? Or is it merely a matter of what they used to say, I'm using medical terms here, of exploring your wife's fecundity? It's a technical term for how many kids you could possibly have in your reproductive life. Do you and your wife have the obligation to continue to have children until she can't have any more? It's a legitimate question. Only women so far, I've noticed. And here's another one. Diane calling from her car. Hi, Diane. Welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm glad Catherine called in, because I was beginning to think maybe if I called in I would sound like the wet blanket. But I agree with Catherine. I do agree with the other callers. They have very valid points. However, again, how many is enough? I have an aunt who's Catholic. She has 14 children. You know, sometimes you can have more children than really you have time to adequately care for. I mean, her family turned out beautifully, but my husband and I, between the two of us, have 5. We have 5 daughters. We kept trying for a son. We would love to have had a son, but how many do we keep trying for? I believe God gives us technology to use for good or for evil. A form of birth control has always been used all the way back to ancient times, whether you call it the rhythm method or even abstinence can be considered a form of birth control in itself. So, you know, for what it's worth, I think that we can use things to the glory of God and, you know, plan our family out. We personally did use birth control, and I don't have any qualms about that. I know there must be many Protestant families who do, because you don't see a lot of extremely large families within the Protestant community.
Right, you see the 2-3 child family there, and actually
exactly.
3 is considered a large family nowadays. Very interesting to say. Diane, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for giving us a call. Okay, we plant our crops in a row, don't we? They're planting something right now, because we were on our way to church, and to and from church, I saw the tractors in the fields, and they were planting something. And it's all planted in rows, so that when it's harvested, it can be harvested easily with our mechanized systems. We use herbicide. We use a special kind of seed. We plant in fields. We put boundaries around those fields. We rotate crops, things like that. We use technology to regulate I'll use the neutral term, to regulate how we harvest the bountiful blessings of God's good gifts of food from the earth, don't we? Yeah. And someone might argue, well, how is birth control judiciously practiced any different from that? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I'm hearing heavy breathing on the line. Jeff, are you the one breathing heavy over there?
Yeah, on this issue, well, just so our listeners know, we have four children.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You know,
well,
that.
No, not you and me.
Yeah, no.
You and your wife.
That's right, that's right.
Yes.
But you know what? I have to confess, on this issue, I held the term that you and I abhor, the Lutheran in name only position, which is... We assume it's Lutheran because it's not Roman Catholic.
Okay.
And that's how I came to my opinions on the issue of contraception. It's basically Lutheran name only. I just assumed that the Roman Catholics were wrong on the issue.
Or that they were overstating their case or something like
exactly,
that. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's one of those things where, I almost don't even want to look at the science of it because of my conscience might be pricked on this issue.
Yeah.
Do you know where I'm coming from?
I know exactly where you're coming from. Absolutely. And the science is a little muddy at times. But you know what? Did we get a caller, Jeff, at the very beginning of this open lines that was a guy? Am I imagining a male caller at the very beginning of Open Line?
No, we had the email from the Greg in Memphis for Alan Carlson.
Okay, but our callers have been... I've got Selena, Jeannie, Jean, Catherine, Diane. We may have missed one in there. All women so far. What does it tell you as the consummate producer of this radio program? I know we have male listeners, by the way, because our callers usually run mostly male. What do you think's going on here?
I don't know. I don't think men want to be honest on the issue. Because I think contraception does allow more, I don't want to say casual sex. I'm talking between husband and wife. I don't know. I don't want to go there, Todd.
Consequence-free?
Yeah, consequence. Yeah, that would be
I hate
good.
Calling children consequences.
I mean, I'll be honest with you, we have four children. I don't know. I have no idea how we'll be able to pay for these children. You trust God. But it's spooky. It's scary. You know what I'm saying? I don't trust God the way I should.
Right, because you're worried about you're thinking, should we add to the Schwarz clan? Because if we do, one of these kids isn't going to get to go to college or dental school or something
right.
like that.
Yeah, but I mean, in my heart, a first commandment. I can say I don't trust God the way I should.
Well, then that's clear. That's clear. If someone says we're going to practice contraception because we don't trust God to take care of us and our kids. That's clear. That's absolutely clear. I can deal with an honest answer like that. And I have to admit, along with Jeff, you bet. Why do I sit there and worry about paying the bills? Because I don't trust God. It's that simple. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address is issues@kfuo.org. It's Monday, May the 21st. We're talking about contraception. In just a few minutes, starting at 4 o'clock, Dr. Thomas von Hagel is going to join us. We'll talk about Emperor Constantine. Was he a Christian, or was he just a politician who found Christianity a very convenient vehicle to further his aims and the aims of his empire? Good question to ask about Constantine. Coming up here in about 5 minutes on the program. Let's go to the phones again, where Chet is waiting in his car. Hi, Chet.
Good evening.
Hello.
Well, Pastor Todd, you asked the question, is using contraceptives a sin? I never really thought about it on those terms, and I'm trying to come to some conclusion on it. I guess I would say that if we're doing something contrary to what God intended, He intended for us to procreate within the bond of marriage, you know, and have to be fruitful and multiply, the passage you kept referring to. So I guess it would have to be that we're disobeying God's will. It would be a sin. But I think the one caller earlier who said that we've become a selfish society made a very good point. You know, it's very disquieting to hear women in today's society say they don't want children. You know, I just get a eerie feeling to hear that. You know, and if people just want to enjoy the privilege of their own lives without the responsibility. It's similar along the lines with abortion. You know, that's why we resort to contraceptive. But in regards to what Jeff was talking about, you know, people make the statement that they can't afford children. I don't think you afford children. You have the children and you depend on the Lord to make a way. In other words, if you can't afford them, you're saying there's some material gain that you won't be afforded by having children.
Then you bought it. There you go, Chet. You put your finger on it because, you know, if you're talking about a family in India that has seven children, you know, I'll talk to that guy about not being able to afford children. You talk about the average middle-class American. It's not a matter of not being able to afford the kids. It's about not being able to afford the new car if you have the kids, or the big screen TV if you have the kids, or the boat, or the vacation, or something along those lines if you have the kids. You're right, Chet. You put your finger on it. Now, I'm going to go back to the phones because we've got an almost full board, but let's bear in mind, when we're talking about contraception being a sin, it really has a two-part answer. One is, if you're talking contraception in terms of, regardless of how it's related to the abortion issue, that is, are contraceptives, oral contraceptives, in fact, abortifacients? If they're abortifacients, it's a sin. There's no two ways about it. But what I'm asking is contraception, apart from the issue of its possible connection to abortion, is it a sin? Christian calls from his car. Hi, Christian.
Hi, Pastor Todd. Kind of tying in with the last caller about the economic necessity, I think in the old traditional ways, when you had multi-generational families, that the previous generation required a lot of children also to be there to take care of them in a society which at those days was not a so-called welfare state. I mean, in my own case, in my family, I have family tree going back to 1500s, and 60 to 70% of the children didn't even make it to adulthood due to disease, famine, etc.
Right, you had a lot of children because the infant mortality rate was outrageously high.
Exactly, and the people needed their children to be there to take care of them in their old age. So I believe there was also an economic necessity to have a lot of children, despite the theological requirement that the church is putting on people.
Christian, thank you very much. You know, that's true. I think it is safe to say that 100 years ago, people didn't plan for their retirement. They had kids. That was their retirement. The retirement was their children. Chantry from Lombard, Illinois. Well, thanks for waiting. Welcome.
Thank you. Good listening to this topic, one that, as a young father myself, I'm like to hear about. And since you were having few male callers, I thought I would call in and add my two cents. I would say that I have a couple things. One of them is that contraception on demand, or you know, the pill and things that make basically they make sex on demand available. I think that the fruit of those shows that they are not good.
All right, Chantry, can you hang on the line?
Sure.
All right, I'm going to ask you to hang on the line through this break. It's a little long; it's about 4 minutes, but we'll all be patient. And we'll get to the other points that Chantry's making from Lombard, Illinois, because I think they're valuable. We're talking here about contraception. What has been the fruit of contraception in our society, just generally speaking? Do you think contraception is a sin? Have Protestants not sufficiently examined the issue? We'll get more of this on the other side. We'll continue open lines after this.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.